Hi, I'm Umushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Beyond the Microscope. This is Lindsay and Mumu. Today we have Jill Scott with us. She is a PhD candidate at the University of Iowa and she is getting her degree in anthropology. Jill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the program.
So let's start with what does someone like you getting a PhD in anthropology do? What's your research topic and what do you focus on?
So my research topic, I am specifically looking at the craniofacial evolution of humans. Specifically, I'm looking basically across the last half a million years or so at how faces changed. And my specific topic is looking at why we have a chin. Because the chin, having a projecting chin or a projecting protuberance on the bottom part of the lower jaw is something that we really only see in modern humans. We don't see it in any of the ancestral species leading up to us. So that's been the focus of my PhD research, is looking at why we have that feature.
How does one pick that as a topic to research?
That's an excellent question that I get often, because that's a very myopic thing to be looking at, most people think, which is true. But in basically every introductory anthropology course, we teach students that that's one of the hallmarks of looking for a modern human. If you're looking at a fossil that you just excavated of a lower jaw, does it have any marker of a chin? Yes, probably Homo sapiens, our own species. No, then it's probably something else. And so this is something that's really ingrained in anthropology majors very early on, that a chin is a very human characteristic. I was always kind of interested in it and assumed that because it's something that has always been a human characteristic for, you know, we've always known it to be a human characteristic for at least 100 years in anthropology, I'd assumed that we knew why we have a chin, but we actually don't. I found that out when I started grad school, and I knew what time period I was interested in researching, but I didn't necessarily know what specific topic. And my advisor was working with a student actually in orthodontics on a project looking at variation in the chin in modern humans. And he wanted a student to look at it more from the evolutionary side of things. And so he suggested to me that I look into it for my dissertation. So I didn't necessarily come up with it all on my own, but my advisor planted the seed and I ran with it.
So when you say modern human, what time frame are we talking about?
So when I talk about modern humans, and this is something that, depending on which anthropologist you ask, could vary, but what I mean by that is members of our own species, Homo sapiens. And the earliest fossil evidence we have for Homo sapiens dates to close to 200,000 years ago, and it was found in East Africa. So that's what I mean when I refer to modern humans, is anything that looks like us that is 200,000 years or younger, pretty much.
And how did you get interested in anthropology?
So my interest in anthropology, to be honest, I didn't know what I wanted to do for a very long time. Throughout middle school, high school, and people would ask, I just didn't really know what I wanted to focus on. When I got to college and was able to take a bunch of classes in fields that I had only ever tangentially heard of, I knew I was very interested in social sciences, and I took a lot of social science courses, and I knew I was interested in anthropology, but didn't know much about it. So I took anthropology, I really liked it. But I didn't necessarily know that that's what I wanted to do. And actually, I went to community college first because it was really cheap to get all of my credits out of the way, all of the gen ed credits. So I did that. And when I transferred to a four-year school, I had to pick a major. And I kind of picked anthropology because I knew I liked it. And it's such a broad field that I figured I would find something in it that I liked to do. Because the field of anthropology is so broad, I actually started out being more interested in the cultural side of things, but through time and through my coursework, wound up becoming much more interested in the more scientific side of things. So picking it as a major was really because I didn't know what I wanted to do, and it's so broad that I knew I'd find something, and sure enough, I did.
Well, it leaves your options open, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you study sort of why modern humans have chins. How does one go about positing a theory and then going about and trying to figure out if that's true?
So like I mentioned earlier, a lot of research has been paid attention to this topic already because the first fossil that was discovered and recognized to be not a Homo sapiens, not a member of our own species, was a Neanderthal, and that was in 1856 in Germany. And so, and a quick side note about Neanderthals. So most people say Neanderthal with the TH because that's how it's spelled. But the German pronunciation of TH is tall. So scientifically,
so we've been wrong all along is what you're saying.
So the way I say it is if you say Neanderthal, then I guess you're insulting someone, but Neanderthal is the actual species. And I like Neanderthals it. Actually have larger brains than modern humans. So really, you're probably insulting Neanderthals by calling a human a Neanderthal. So it's not an insult.
I like it.
So when Neanderthals were discovered, when it was originally discovered, it was actually, so Neanderthals are overall a lot more robust and just bigger. They're shorter than modern humans, but they're stockier. Like they're just kind of more largely built, like larger muscles and so forth. And this includes having kind of a more robust, skull and lower jaw and everything too. But the front of their lower jaw doesn't have a projecting chin, as I kind of mentioned earlier. So the original Neanderthal that was discovered, it was actually thought that it was a Prussian soldier that had some type of pathology. And then eventually, and it was discovered at a quarry, which is how a lot of the early fossil hominins were discovered, is that some type of mineral resource was being extracted and the people who were doing the quarrying just found these skeletal remains coming out. And usually they just got kind of trashed, but in this case, they took it to a local science teacher, and he is the one who initially kind of realized, I think this might be something more interesting than just a pathological soldier. So since that happened well over a century ago, ever since then, people have realized, okay, so this Neanderthal, which we're now realizing is not a human, it's a separate species that no longer is around. It doesn't have a chin, but we do. And then as more and more fossils have been discovered over that period of time from different species, and we see, well, they don't have chins and we do. People have been very interested in coming up with ideas for why that is. So in the literature, there have been various hypotheses put forth for why we have chins and they don't. And many of them have been tested, but not many of them have really been disproven. Some have been more or less favored than others. So, for example, one of the more popular ones is that we have a chin as a buttress for chewing. So it's a biomechanical hypothesis that it's an adaptation to help us chew. The problem with this is that we don't see a buttress like this necessarily in other hominins or even other species. The other thing is many studies have been done that actually use like electromyography. So basically looking at the chewing forces that are dissipated through the jaws when chewing in various different primate species. And they show that, and also there have been studies done using CT scans of modern humans where they use a regular one and they use another CT scan that they basically just defeatured it from having a chin. So they modified it and then did various tests to see how the mandible would warp in response to simulated chewing forces. And all of these studies essentially show that having a forward protruding chin does not actually have any effect on how chewing forces are dissipated. So that's been a popular hypothesis. And it has been tested, and it has been largely shown to not necessarily be a factor. Another popular hypothesis that's been around is that we have a chin as an adaptation for articulate speech, because humans, obviously, right now, we're doing this, using our capacity for articulate speech, and the muscles of the tongue attach on the backside of the chin. But again, there have been similar studies done looking at how stresses actually dissipate across the anterior or across the front of the lower jaw during speech. And they show that speech does not put enough strain on the mandible for it to necessitate having a chin. Another idea about why we have a chin. I'm getting close to the end, but there are a lot of ideas.
No. I'm fascinated by all of them.
So I know, this is amazing.
Please continue.
Well, so I was teaching a class, another little side note, but teaching classes where you have to talk about at the beginning of the semester the scientific method. And I love the scientific method, but it's not the most exciting thing to teach to a class of undergrads who are taking a general class to get their science credit out of the way. And so I was going through it and I realized, oh, I'm going to put forth my dissertation research to them and say, okay, so humans have a chin, but why do we have a chin? What are some hypotheses? Like, what do you use that part of your face for? And so my students came up with all kinds of things. They came up with the chewing hypothesis. They came up with speech. They thought maybe it was an adaptation for kissing. But again,
hey, why not?
Yeah, well, exactly. My dad likes to come up with hypotheses all the time, and usually I can rebut them. But, just an aside, that made me a lot more excited about teaching the scientific method, and they got a lot more into it too, I think. But you put this forth, and, anyone in the general public usually can come up with pretty good hypotheses, many of which have already been put forth in the scientific literature. One other one is that maybe it was basically evolved due to sexual selection, since men tend to have a larger or more prognathic or protruding chin than women, a more square jaw and all those things. Mm-hmm. But both men and women have a chin, and usually when we see a trait sexually selected for, you see it in one sex versus the other. You don't see it in both. So there certainly is evidence that having a more projecting chin or a stronger chin within reason is more visually appealing, more visually attractive to people than having a weak chin. There have been studies that have documented that, but I don't think that sexual selection is necessarily the reason why we have a chin. So the main hypothesis that I'm looking at is that it's not actually adaptive. There's been a tendency in the past for a lot of evolutionary biologists to look at a feature as though it is something that is advantageous. It was something that was specifically selected for. But there are a number of different evolutionary forces in action, and evolution is not directionally driven, as a lot of people think. It's a tinkerer. The idea... And this idea has been put forth in the literature quite a bit, but for a variety of reasons, it hasn't been tested a whole lot. And that's largely because of new technologies that we have now. So the idea is that the chin actually is kind of a passive byproduct, or what a lot of evolutionary biologists call a spandrel, meaning that it's just there as kind of an artifact of selection acting to change other parts of the craniofacial skeleton. So we see throughout hominin evolution, hominins, by the way, are basically, it's the term that's used for humans and our family tree. So from the time that the human lineage split from the chimpanzee lineage, which, depending on whose estimate you follow, is anywhere from about 5 to 7 million years ago. So hominin refers to anything along the human lineage since that time that was split off from the chimpanzee lineage. So we see throughout hominin evolution, earlier hominins that are closer to that chimpanzee split generally have a more prognathic face, which means more projecting face. So the whole face, basically from the nose on down, tends to be more projecting. And you can see this if you look at a chimpanzee, their face is more projecting than ours, for example. But throughout time, we see hominin faces getting flatter and kind of retreating backwards more underneath the brain case. And this coincides with an increase in the neurocranium. So the front portion, basically, of the brain is getting larger and expanding, the neocortex. And so we see with humans, especially since the 200,000 year ago time frame, roughly, our foreheads get more vertical and more flat, and the face tucks underneath the forehead and the neurocranium. And as that happens, it drags the upper teeth backwards. And so the lower teeth need to maintain proper occlusion for proper chewing. So the lower teeth get dragged backwards, but the chin remains behind, or forwards, depending on how you look at it, because there's no selection to move the chin backwards with the rest of the face. And the other part of that is that it likely there isn't selection to move the chin backwards, in part because we need enough space behind the chin for the tongue and all the soft tissue of the throat. And there have been some studies that look at the positioning of kind of the throat muscles relative to the chin, and it shows that we do need all the space that we currently have there.
So why would we sort of evolutionarily shrink that if we didn't have to? Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Makes sense.
Interesting.
Makes a lot of sense.
Now, here's a question. Because you spend so much time studying chins and facial structures, do you do that while you're looking at people, or is it only sort of focused when you're doing research? I mean, are you sort of looking at somebody going, oh, that's interesting. It's a neat shape you've got to your face there.
That person's more evolved and, you know, normal.
And that is always people's follow-up question when I tell them what I study.
I knew it.
Yeah, everyone gets all self-conscious about their chin all of a sudden, and I'm like,
now
don't worry about it.
Now you wonder why we turn the video off.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was thinking. It's like, no, that's why you don't want me to see your face. Yeah. But really, I notice particularly strong or particularly weak chins, and mm-hmm. so does pretty much everyone who knows me and knows what I study now. Everyone else will say, wow, do you see that guy's chin?
You're like, yeah, no.
So there are certain people, you know, Jay Leno, of course. He appears right on some of my lecture slides from time to time. but various other actors. People always point out Bruce Campbell to me as another one. But for the most part, I'm not seriously studying people's faces or people's right cranial shapes, unless they have some particularly unique feature.
You had mentioned when the Neanderthal was sort of discovered that, you know, they realized it was a different species. How do you distinguish different species just looking at sort of skeletal remains? Is there something in particular that you can sort of characterize?
That's a good question, and that's a lot of what we as paleoanthropologists are trying to do. I would say early in the history of paleoanthropology, it was a lot of comparative anatomy. People were comparing the newly discovered skeletal material to what we knew already, which was just modern humans and then other apes, other living apes. And so by that method, it was a lot of more qualitative comparisons, I think, especially because if all you have to go off of is humans and apes, well, human and ape skeletons look pretty different. Human, I should say, and non-human primate apes. So it's a matter of degree in a lot of ways. Now, over time, we've developed more quantitative ways of discerning these things, such as characterizing traits, on more of a specific scale, or what I specifically do is called geometric morphometrics. And this is a method where you take landmarks. So you look at either the actual skull, or I take 3D scans, and a lot of people use CT scans and other things like that, and take measurements directly off of those. And then you can compare those measurements. And this doesn't have to be on skulls. It can be on any part of the skeleton. But you can compare those measurements statistically to see where the differences fall. Now, it's a little bit of interpretation. It's not 100% hardcore quantitative differences. And that's where a lot of paleontologists will run into issues. You know, usually whenever a new species is announced, not everyone agrees about it right off the bat, because mm-hmm. different people will see, well, no, this looks more similar to this other species that's already been named. And so there's naming species in the paleontological record is a little bit of a moving target for that reason.
All right, so we have to ask, because this is really what we're really excited about talking to you about. And Mumu's like bouncing in her seat right now.
I'm like, Lindsay, ask a question.
We want to talk to you about the project you worked on with the why can I not? The Homo naledi? Naledi?
Naledi, yeah. Homo naledi. Yeah, I was just thinking. I was like, we should probably get to
when
that,
are we getting there? Yeah. No. Yeah. Don't worry, I edit. Don't worry. But anyway, the Homo Naledi, tell us about what it's like to work on it. It's a story and a discovery that, you know, made a lot of headlines all over the world, which I'm sure a lot of your work doesn't necessarily. So tell us a little bit about working on it and what you did and what that was like.
So I was part of the team. Homo Naledi got a lot of press ever since the excavations began, but I was part of the team that got involved after the excavation was done. They had a big workshop in South Africa in May of 2014. It involved a lot of early career scientists, and they put out a call on social media saying, hey, we have this huge assemblage of fossil material. We're looking for young individuals who we want to get involved in this project, who have a lot of data so that we have comparative data to compare this new fossil species to, and who have, you know, some type of skill set that'll be useful to analyzing the material. And so I applied to be part of that research team, and I was accepted. And we were there for about 5 weeks working day and night, basically, on analyzing this material in teams based upon basically our area of anatomical expertise. So I was part of the team that studied the cranial and mandibular material. And it was really exciting. I mean, we were working at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, and they had just built this big vault, essentially, for all of their fossils. So not just the Homo Naledi fossils, but all of the other fossil material that they house there that's largely South African fossils. And it was basically this big room that had this giant like vault door on it, so we got to work in there all day. And as soon as we all stepped foot in there, there were about 30 of us early career scientists, and it was just, you know, kind of buzzing with really excited nerd scientific energy the whole time while we got to piece together, because that's another thing about Homo Naledi is the assemblage is fairly fragmentary. We have a lot of material, but we don't have like a complete skull, for example. So we had to piece together a lot of the parts of the skull to see what we had and to see whether or not it was a species that we already knew about, or see if it was a brand new species that we were discovering.
What is it like being, I mean, I know you said that it was just buzzing, but do you feel like you're doing something, that touching something, looking at something that nobody else has looked at before? Is there sort of an edge to doing something like that?
Yeah, it was, I mean, it's very exciting for anyone who's an anthropologist to see any of these fossils, because they are so rare and so precious. And so when I was collecting data in Europe too, I was looking at fossils that tons of people had looked at before, but seeing it in person is really, you know, an exciting thing. And especially working with Homo Naledi, and especially as an early career scientist, again, because usually when something new is excavated, it's more often than not a group of established scientists who gets to look at it and do the initial analysis and publication and everything. So that was one of the things that was really neat, was getting to have this experience so early in my career.
Well, so actually I had read somewhere that this was sort of new, that they brought in a lot of early career scientists for it. Was there a reason for that decision to bring you guys in as opposed to the more experienced team?
Yeah, I mean, there were more experienced senior people who are heading up the project, of course, and they had apparently decided early on that they wanted to try to open it up and do it in this workshop format and bring in more early career people. And I think the large reason why was because they wanted to give us this opportunity and experience early in our careers, instead of having to wait 20 or 30 or 40 years to get the opportunity to have that kind of network to do that. So they wanted to do that in part to help us with our careers, but I think also in part because it brought in people with new perspectives, because we had all been trained at different places by different people. We had a lot of us been using newer technologies for our research that they were not necessarily familiar with from a hands-on perspective. So I think they wanted us for that reason too, is just so that we had a lot of different and kind of fresher perspectives in the room instead of just, you know, kind of the same old.
Obviously finishing your PhD is on your list of things to do, but what if you had a dream project to work on or a dream skeleton to study or something, what's on your list of things you want to be doing?
It would be really nice. There's a very large sample of fossil hominins in Spain. Cima de los Huesos is the name of the site. And that's from more of the time period that my research is more interested in, kind of the middle Pleistocene. That would be great to work on if I ever wound up with the opportunity to do that. There's also a pretty big collection of Homo erectus at the site called Dinanisi, which is in the Republic of Georgia in the Caucasus, and that would be pretty nice to work on. There's also a lot of Asian material that I haven't had the chance to see or work with, especially Asian Homo erectus material from China and Indonesia. But there's all kinds of stuff that would be great to be involved in and to get to work on. There's also a lot of Neanderthal material in Croatia, and I did get to study some of that during my research, but there are ongoing excavations there that I think it would be really exciting to be a part of, especially because Croatia is just beautiful. I'd love to get back there. So,
do you prefer hands-on research, or are you just as enamored with digital renderings of things?
I'm definitely more enamored with seeing the fossils in person. The digital renderings, though, that's one of the great things about where our technology is moving, is that, yeah, it's a lot more exciting to go somewhere and see the fossils in person, but that's also a lot more expensive, and it can be very difficult to get the funding to do that. And it can also be difficult to get permission to see some of that material sometimes, whereas a lot of it is becoming increasingly available for free via these digital renderings online, which I think is great for opening up who's able to do the research. Because even if you don't have the funding, often you can get many of the 3D renderings, laser scans, etc., online, and there's also free software online that you can use to actually look at that material and take measurements off of it. So I think it makes science a lot more accessible to a lot more people that way. And that's one of the things too that was great about the Homo Naledi project, is we put 3D scans up on a site called Morphosaurus. And so anyone can download them and look at them and 3D print them. And a number of colleagues across the world have been 3D printing them and sharing them with their students. So it's really nice to be able to bring that into the classroom.
I have one more, and this is sort of just out of curiosity for myself. Do you have enough data samples out there for what you need to do? Or are there people, or not you specifically, but just are there, you know, PhD candidates sitting there waiting for the next big discovery in order to get enough sort of evidence or data for them to work on?
Most of us are told that that is a core project design, if that's what you're waiting for. Most of us design our PhD projects so that we can use largely material that's already been excavated. Some people, even if they are excavating a site for their dissertation, they will still usually be also using material from other sites so that they don't fall into that trap of excavating a site for 3 years and having nothing to show for it. So we rely quite a bit on comparative materials, whether it's other fossils, or a lot of biological anthropologists, for example, will use a large modern human comparative collection or a large ape comparative collection, so looking at gorilla and chimp skeletons in addition to humans and things like that.
This is my last question, so and you may not have a good answer to this, but is there something that's a big misconception about your field? Obviously, I ask the cliched questions about whether you stare at people at their chins and all these other things. So there's a similar approach to things, but is there something that, like, people assume that you do, or that people think you should be doing, and you're really like, no, that's not how this works, guys. Sorry.
I would say there are at least a couple things. One is the whole Indiana Jones perception, right? That we're off in caves battling snakes and all this kind of stuff. And usually, I mean, if you're doing field work or really lab work, anything like that, it's a lot more meticulous than it's portrayed in TV and movies and so forth. It's a lot of staring at Excel spreadsheets and running statistics. And so that's the far less romantic side of things that you may or may not want people to know about. But that's what we spend a lot of time doing, is statistics and writing. And we kind of, I think most of us live for the opportunity to go out into the field and be excavating. But even that, the excavations are, you know, slow, and you're very careful about documenting the context of everything. It's not just digging and finding bones and cool stuff and just pulling it out of the ground right then. It's a lot more detailed work than that. And the other thing that I would say is a lot of people are always asking about the missing link, and that's not how evolution works, and it's certainly not how human evolution works. And I think that Homo naledi is a good example of that, because the species really is a mosaic of kind of more ancestral characteristics, like having really long curved fingers that look particularly well adapted for climbing activity, and also having a small brain size that is more ancestral. It's not as large as we would expect for a species in the genus Homo. But that's combined with things like having a wrist that looks like it was really capable of like manual dexterity. So perhaps capable of making and utilizing stone tools, although we have not found any stone tool evidence yet associated with the species. They also had very human-like looking feet, which would suggest that in a lot of ways they were walking just like us. And this particular suite of characteristics we wouldn't have necessarily expected to find all in one species, because we usually think of a large brain also coinciding with smaller teeth and the ability to make stone tools, because we're making stone tools and processing food that allows teeth to get smaller and so on and so forth. And so really I want to dispel any notions of the whole missing link idea. It's not unidirectional evolution, just marching all in kind of the same direction. We've got every fossil we find is informative about where we come from.
Yeah, that's a big point. It's yes. Not, you know,
every time a new fossil is found, there's a headline reading, is this the new missing link? Well, there's no missing
link.
No, it's not, because there isn't one. There isn't just one.
Minor details. Come on now. Well, Jill, this has been great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and share this. It's been fascinating. I feel like Mumu and I both are wishing we were anthropologists and archaeologists in our past lives or something like that. But thank you for taking the time and talking to us.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's been fun.
Like our show? Find us on iTunes or at scopepodcast.com, and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Mumu Shu
and Lindsay Claiborne.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycats. Thanks for listening.